Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. The University of Tulsa celebrates its new creative writing major with a creative writing celebration tonight and tomorrow. The event will get underway this evening with a student and alumni reading at the Mainline Bar, but the main event takes place tomorrow at Terrell Hall on the TU campus, as a number of writers, including Rilla Askew, Benjamin Lytle, and my guest today, will gather to speak about the craft of writing. My guest today is 2014 National Book Award winner Phil Cly. His debut book of short stories on marine life in the Iraq War won the National Book Award for Fiction, as well as the National Book Critics Circle's Best Debut Book, the John Leonard Award. The Dartmouth graduate and Marine Corps veteran will be speaking on the personal and political stakes of storytelling after war. That takes place at 11 a.m. tomorrow in the Terrell Hall Auditorium. Cly's work has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Newsweek, and Granta, among others. And he's my guest today on Studio Tulsa. Phil Cly, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And congratulations on redeployment, the National Book Award, and everything that has happened in your life since you first began writing. Now, I know you went back to school to get a creative writing degree, and redeployment, the title story of your collection, was the first one you published. Was that the first effort to write about your time in Iraq?
It was my first time writing about Iraq. I started that story, a couple months after I got back from Iraq in 2008. I wasn't writing necessarily about my experiences, but it was a kind of way in to think about what redeployment feels like, what America looks like when you get back, which is certainly a concern of the whole book. And I ended up working on that story for a couple of years afterwards.
And in this story, it's about a sergeant who's coming back from Iraq. He's coming back to North Carolina, where he's stationed. And just sort of the disconnect of going from an urban... there was a great little section in this story where the sergeant is going shopping, actually, a matter of fact, with his wife. And it's the first time he's in an urban area where he's trying to sort of turn off all those heightened sense of perception of being in a hostile environment. That was really a nice little section in that particular story. And that's sort of the point of the story, is how do you turn off these things that have been, your senses that have been running at full tilt?
Right. And it's this strange thing where in World War II, the guys got on a boat, and it was a long time on that slow boat home, trading stories, waiting to get back to America before they eventually made it. And in current wars, you have a situation where you get on an aircraft, passenger aircraft, sit in your little plush chair, looking up at the nozzle, shooting air conditioning. And then in a matter of, half a day, you go from the Middle East back to America, and it's very jarring. And then, of course, what we ask of modern soldiers and Marines is they stay back home for a period of time and then go out again and again and again and again. And so it's not just how you turn that off that becomes an issue for some folks, but you might not totally want to turn off that sensibility that's very much geared for a combat environment, because you might be going out again. And so all the things that the kind of ways of behaving and just intense alertness and reaction to the environment around you and to possible threats, all those things make a lot of sense in a combat zone. It make you a more useful Marine, make you more useful to the people around you who are depending upon you for their life. And then they're not particularly useful while going shopping in Wilmington, North Carolina.
There was one story which sort of points up, I think, another one of the central points of the book, and that is the disconnect between most of American society and American military society, and I'm saying, or culture, maybe is a better word.
Sure.
And it's the story OIF, Operation Iraqi Freedom, and you tell the story almost completely through acronyms that a military culture family would know, and the rest of American culture, the larger American culture, you're going to Wikipedia to be able to read the story.
Well, I didn't want people going to Wikipedia to read the story, and I kept it short. It's only like a couple of pages. I knew that I couldn't push it longer than that. But yeah, that story is an acronym in almost every sentence, and often more than one. And it was a way for me to play with you know, the military language, the way that it can be used to obscure things, also the way that it can be emotive, right? I think there, you know, in the military, we love acronyms. We have, sometimes we even have acronyms embedded within acronyms. you know, IDD and IED detection dog. But for a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, there's some acronyms like IED, which have more sort of emotional content than improvised explosive device, which is what those letters stand for. It becomes a new word and you know, acquires its own resonance. And so, yeah, that story was me playing with the different ways in which military language is used and the way that it kind of intersects with the culture.
Can you give us a sense of why IED has a different meaning for somebody who has been in Iraq and Afghanistan than somebody who's been here stateside reading about it?
Because it's what is on your mind constantly as you're driving down the roads every day. And I don't, you know, it's a strange thing because on the one hand, there's a degree of fear. On the other hand, I remember talking to a Marine to explain that he actually liked driving in Iraq better than driving back home because, you know, people got out of your way. you know, you can get stuck in traffic or anything like that. You would get stuck, of course, if you spotted an IED and you had to wait for EOD to come and the bomb disposal guys to come and pick it up. But IEDs are the number one killer of American troops. And particularly in very violent sections of Iraq, that was something that would be constantly on your mind.
Well, it's interesting that the characters in redeployment in the various stories have very different relationships. For some, it's that abject fear that you're talking about. Others, it's mm-hmm. almost like a daredevil, devil-may-care attitude. For others, it's fatalism. It strikes, you know, that term strikes your characters differently throughout the book.
Going to depend on, first off, the different person and their different relationships to the war. And obviously some people really like it. They feel like they have a sense of meaning, purpose, clarity, excitement, community overseas. And for some people, it's just utterly awful. And it's also going to be so dependent on what type of job you were doing, where you were, when you were there. I have two friends, they're both named Matt, they're both Catherine, they're both scouts. They served in the exact same section of Iraq. They even worked with the same translator, an Iraqi translator whose nickname was Suge Knight because he loved American rap music. And but you know, one of them was there in early 2006. One of them was there in 2008. And when they talk about their deployment, it's radically different, even though they're doing the exact same job, because it was just a very different time with a different strategy and a different level of violence.
Well, one of the things that comes up is a term for crazy place for Iraq that sort of transcends story from story to story. And many of these stories are, well, we mentioned OIF earlier, and that was a guy who was basically, his job was to pay out money to people whose property or something had been destroyed and the government was making restitutions. Money as a weapon system takes the approach of a foreign service officer who's really trying to make some small difference. He wants to get a water plant going. One of his more seasoned colleagues is saying, you know, we ought to teach the widows how to be beekeepers. That's a product they can sell. And he thinks it's crazy. Right. And yet his higher-ups, getting pressure from a congressman, says, you need to teach the kids to play baseball. This story just shows this utter insanity of this occupation, and the whole effort.
Well, you know, that story was me thinking about somebody arriving in Iraq, dealing with the aftermath of a lot of bad policy, and trying, nevertheless, to find some way of being useful, of affecting an outcome for the better. And he's sort of schooled in how you might do that by this army officer who he at first thinks is a total idiot. But he sort of later sort of comes to understand that this guy actually sort of understands and just kind of accepts the insanity of the bureaucratic process, and because of that, knows how to manipulate it.
Yeah. Now, you tell your stories through a lot of different personas. Did you come into, obviously some from a combat situation. There's others from a mortuary affairs soldier who's working on body recovery. Another, again, we mentioned the Foreign Service officer's perspective, a chaplain's perspective in another story. Did you sort of run through a lot of these, if not people, these sort of professions within your time in Iraq and got to understand a little bit of what was going through their mind, or is this just pure imagination on your part?
Well, so it's a variety of things. I did end up spending time with a lot of different types of Marines and soldiers and sailors in Iraq. So I spent time with infantrymen, I spent time with mortuary affairs specialists, I spent time with, you know, medical personnel and chaplains and so on. I also did a lot of research when I was writing the book. So I would go out and I'd interview somebody who you know, did a job like I was trying to write about, you know, writing about a guy in an artillery unit. And I'd interview an artilleryman or a couple. And I also read a lot. I read a lot of, just a lot of good journalism, a lot of good books about various issues in Iraq. And then of course, you mix the research and your own experience with imagination and see what you come up with.
Now your deployment in Iraq was during the insurgency or the surge, or when exactly?
Right, it was during the surge. So I went into Anbar province in January 2007. This was, 2006 had been a very violent year. Anbar was the heart of the Sunni insurgency. It was, where ISIS first sprung back up in Iraq. Back then, it was the same organization. It was called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they basically ruled the, the villages and the towns through, murder and intimidation. It was a big tactic of theirs early on in our deployment, a huge suicide bomb outside our main gate that detonated in a group of families going to mosque because the local police chief had started moving against insurgents. So it was a very, very violent place. Intelligence assessments from 2006 had called Anbar the lost province. And then during the course of the year that I spent in Iraq, violence just went down precipitously, right? I mean, I remember driving through Ramadi and seeing markets open up and sort of amazing. And so a lot of us left feeling very positively about what had happened, what we've been a part of, the surge. And then, of course, we all, over the past couple of years, watched everything unravel with a sort of sense of horror and grief.
Well, some of your stories coming in the Anbar province, thinking of the Foreign Service officer and a lot of Marines who were doing some incredible work that goes usually outside of the usual job description of Marines in rebuilding that province.
Yeah, and I think that there's, one thing is the military is this giant, complicated organization, and there are a lot of aspects of the exercise of military force or what it means to be a deployed soldier or Marine that a lot of people don't think about when they think about the military and the job that they do. And exploring, what that was and also what it feels like, how you come home and talk about it to other people, that was very important to me when I was writing the book.
And that is a central theme, is how compartmentalized these young men are. And there are many, many of them are really young men. We expect them to behave one way when they're overseas and yet a completely different way when they come back home. And that, as you mentioned earlier, that's an 18-hour plane ride a lot of times.
Right. And also, I think that it's not just the way you behave. For me, having served in Iraq changed the way that I felt about the exercise of American power and what it means, and what it means to be a U.S. citizen. I mean, the fact of the matter is the decisions that we're making here politically, the decisions that we make as a people have huge impact, and not just, obviously, American lives. It's not just, the 18-year-old who's right now, thinking about signing up in the Marine Corps. It's also about the people in those countries. I will never forget some of the things that I saw, and I didn't have a particularly hard deployment, but I did live near a combat hospital. We saw a lot of injured people coming in. Mm-hmm. And so it made the moral stakes of the way that we talk about war back here at home, it made them just so radically different for me. It felt different. And writing the book, I think, was in part me trying to find ways of communicating that sense of disquiet and urgency to people who might not otherwise have a way of entering into the experience.
My guest today is Phil Clye, Marine Corps veteran, a writer, a winner of the National Book Award for his book, Redeployment. It's now out in softcover from Penguin. He'll be a featured guest for the University of Tulsa Creative Writing Symposium this weekend, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. If you can talk a little bit about the disconnect between, again, we kind of started on that and we kind of moved off of it, but this disconnect between most of American culture and American military culture. It seems like this book really is about sharing some of that culture with a dominant culture that has really not felt the issues that a military family that's looking at a soldier go through multiple deployments and the sacrifices those military families and the whole families are making.
Right. I mean, one thing that should be mentioned is we have an all-volunteer force, so it's just a fraction of the country that serves. You know, Stanley McChrystalis talked about how the American people don't have skin in the game when it comes to war. And that changes the way that we talk about it, changes the way that we think about it. And, you know, one of the things that fiction allows you to do is, you know, whether you're talking about war, whether you're talking about any other kind of experience, it allows the reader to slip into the skull of another human being and to try and imagine themselves within a set of circumstances that, you know, on the surface feel very alien. And that was important to me. It's also why I wrote short stories. I wanted to have the opportunity for the reader to slip into all these different skulls, you know, these different characters with very different relationships to the war and feelings about it. Characters who wouldn't necessarily agree with each other about, you know, what their experience meant or what the war meant, but that, you know, hopefully the reader could sort of have a kind of critical engagement with all of them.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned you spent about 2 years working on the title story, Redeployment. Were most of all of these stories that ended up being in the book, Redeployment, were they all written about the same time, or was it just a reaction to Redeployment once it was published in a journal, or what exactly?
No, so I was writing many of the stories at the same time. The book took about 4.5 years to finish. So, you know, many of the stories were in various stages of completion, or it had the idea for one of the stories prior to the title story being published. And then I ended up finishing the book about a year and a half after the title story was published.
When you went, after you came back from Iraq, you went back and got your Master's of Fine Arts, and you studied with Colin McCann, who, there's not a whole lot of resemblance in your writing style, but there is this, the book Redeployment sort of takes one of his favorite things is he'll have this extraordinary event, and yet his book is really about ordinary people living their lives. And, you know, I suppose Redeployment has the same thing. You have this war as a backdrop, and you're telling all these different stories about everyday life in a war zone. Was that conscious at all?
Colin's a writer that I admire very much. I mean, certainly, you know, one thing that he's able to do just beautifully is tie together, if you look at a book like Let the Great Wolf Spin or Transatlantic, all these sort of very distinct and disparate experiences around a kind of common core. And the chorus of voices that you get gives you a much sort of richer sense of the subject that you're dealing with. And so, that certainly was an influence. I also think, you know, one of the things with Colin is you show up to a creative writing program as a veteran of the Iraq War, writing about the Iraq War, and you think, you know, you have the authority to write about this. And Colin is not afraid to call somebody out on their BS, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which he certainly did in a couple of my case. And it was, your first reaction is, who is this guy to tell me that this is, this writing is not being honest? What does he know? The frustrating thing, though, was that he was generally right. So, I have to go back and revise what I was doing. But it was just that was instructive, right? What you can learn, and learning to sort of give up that sense of authority over my subject that I wanted to have unearned, and to kind of try and earn that authority through the quality of the writing itself and not through my own experiences.
Now, as you were writing these stories, I imagine they were coming together as just a set of stories, but as you began thinking about a book, did you think about maybe having some through characters, or did you really just want to make it a series of, here are some snapshots of this big, huge war that one hand doesn't know what the other's doing? And that came off beautifully, I think.
Well, so I knew that I did not want the stories to be interlocking. Mm-hmm. And that said, I did plan the book as a book. The first story is the first one I started writing. The last story is, I think, the second that I started writing. I very early on knew where I was beginning and where I wanted to end. And I knew there were pieces that I wanted to hit. And in my mind, anyway, hopefully, the stories talk to each other. And you see sort of different themes recur in very different circumstances.
Yeah.
But I did not want to kind of try and force a unifying plot on the book. I was actually writing a novel at the same time that I was writing the short stories. And I abandoned it because even though there was, there's material in the novel that I liked quite a bit, the short story collection felt a lot truer to what I wanted to communicate about the war.
Has the success of Redeployment sort of cast you in a role that maybe, I don't know if you're prepared for or unprepared for, but of sort of being a spokesperson for returning veterans? You feel like in many ways?
It's enabled me to speak about issues that I care about to a larger audience than I would have otherwise. I don't necessarily feel like I can represent for the group of veterans, which is a pretty diverse group of people with a diverse range of opinions. But one of the pretty wonderful things is the ability to go and reach out to people and have the kind of conversations that I really wanted to be happening when I got back from Iraq.
And what sort of conversations were those? About the nature of what we're doing over there, whether we need everybody all in?
Conversation about military policy to the narratives of war and how we choose to understand war, experience in war, the act of killing, our relationship to the violence done in our name as American citizens, all sorts of things.
Yeah. The name of the book is Redeployment, and I know everyone's looking forward to the Creative Writing Symposium and hearing more about it. Phil Klei, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Writer and Marine Corps veteran Phil Klei speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He served in Iraq's Anbar province from January 2007 to February 2008. His book of short stories on Marine life in the Iraq War, Redeployment, won the National Book Award. He'll be a guest of the University of Tulsa for their Creative Writing Celebration tomorrow at Terrell Hall. He'll be speaking at 11 a.m. in the auditorium on the personal and political stakes of storytelling after war. More information on the University of Tulsa website. You're listening to Studio Tulsa. Here's the comments of Barry Friedman.
So there I sat on a porch in the Bahamas. It was Easter Sunday, late in the day. I was on my laptop looking at the swordfish and assorted sea life the hotel placed outside my villa, carefully placed outside my villa. I was relaxed. I had just stolen a Diet Coke from the snack bar, as I did every day, and was working on the 14th edit of a book I'm writing when I felt this weird pain in my chest. It wasn't a sharp pain, wasn't a dull pain, wasn't indigestion, wasn't acid reflux. It was none of those things. It was all of those things. What the hell is this, I thought. A heart attack? Nah, couldn't be. Heart attacks are accompanied by shoulder or neck pain, which I didn't have unless you count my shoulder and neck pain, but that, I was almost positive, was from sleeping wrong. A heart attack is also accompanied by pain shooting down your left arm, which I also didn't have unless you count the numbness in my fingers and left foot. This wasn't good. How could I be dying? I'm 59. Wait, why couldn't I be dying? I'm older than Prince. To the hotel nurse I went, who asked if I thought about going to the hospital. What do you think I asked? That's up to you, man. Great, thanks so much. I knew it cost about $5,000 just for the ER. Am I worth it, I thought? Nah. I went back to my room. My daughter, who teaches yoga, once taught me about deep breathing. I wasn't paying attention at the time, but I think she said to take a breath, hold it for 10 seconds, and then exhale. I did it twice. I got dizzy. And now my ankle throbbed. The pain is moving up. A blood clot, no doubt. I've got 45 minutes to live. No sense taking a shower. I emailed my doctor, who's Jewish. I bring that up because, as mentioned, it was Easter. I figured he wouldn't be busy. He wasn't. He wrote back. He assured me I probably wasn't having a heart attack. Probably. Okay, let's go with that. He said he'd call in a prescription. Let me stop right here. Easter Sunday, my doctor is calling in a prescription to a foreign country. Huh? How about that? I digress. Of course, nobody in the Bahamas would fill a prescription. It's Easter Sunday. Some guy's calling from Tulsa who says he's a doctor. He suggested then I buy valerian root. Okay, to the 24-hour pharmacy. This valerian root stinks. It socks after a run, stinks when the pain was now in both arms. Somehow, I thought that was better. Heart attacks don't happen with pain in both arms. Anyway, I knew. I'm done. I knew I should have had a vegetable at least once in the past 30 years, lost some weight, volunteered my time at a shelter. Damn it to hell, my death will be unreported, certainly in the Bahamas. In Tulsa, maybe I'll make the broadcast, maybe. Barry Friedman, humorist, dead at 59. They're going to call me a humorist. I know it. I'm going to be a dead humorist. Okay, I didn't die, obviously. The pain, though, came back. Get this, Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday, but skipped Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and Sunday. I guess I had anxiety with a touch of OCD and paranoia. When I got back to Tulsa, I saw my doctor who ordered an EKG. Now, I hear that physicians can discover heart attacks that patients don't even know they had. I figured on 4, maybe 5, figured I'd soon be on a Mediterranean diet and buying cookbooks specializing in fish and kale. I didn't, though, have any heart attacks. My heart was fine, really fine. No history of abuse, no history of pain, nothing. The pain, apparently, a combination of anxiety, acid reflux, stress, something else, but not a heart attack. I figured anxiety. I wanted Xanax. He gave me Prilosec. I didn't die. I'm still a humorist, but I didn't die. I can build on that. I was scared, though. Not going to lie to you. I was, am grateful. I brought my doctor T-shirts from the Bahamas to thank him. It's something a humorist would do.
Barry Friedman is a writer, essayist, a columnist for the Tulsa Voice, and a regular contributor to Studio Tulsa. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.